Good morning. My name is Sharon Brown, and I'm representing the physician plaintiffs, Dr. Caldwell, Dr. Brofman, and Dr. DeMarco, and Association Plaintiffs Pro English and the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. It is difficult to imagine any plaintiffs with greater personal interest in the policy guidance than these plaintiffs. As the general allegations in the complaint disclose, these plaintiffs have pled sufficient facts to establish standing, and the matter is ripe for judicial resolution. As this Court recognizes, the general allegations in the complaint embrace those specific facts necessary to support the plaintiff's claims. In Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife, if the plaintiff is himself the object of the policy or the agency action, there is ordinarily little question that the action has caused him injury, and a judgment preventing the action will redress those injuries.
What was the injury here?
The physician plaintiffs have stated in their complaint that they are required to change the manner in which they practice practice medicine, and that they are no longer to use their own professional judgment in deciding how best to communicate with their limited English proficient patients. The federal government has mandated that they now use...
Well, wasn't the word may used instead of must?
When the policy guidance requires all physicians who receive federal funding from the Health and Human Services Department to do this four-factor balancing test. The third factor says that the nature and importance of the program activity and the service provided by the programs to the people's life will be a determining factor. And here we've got the physician plaintiffs who do...
Is it a determining factor as opposed to a factor?
No, it is the determining factor, because it says it is more important that if the service is life-threatening or important, that the language services be provided.
But
and the allegations in our complaint state that the physicians understand the policy guidance as to require them to provide the language services.
Do they have any basis for that understanding?
They do, because the explanation for the third factor says that they are required to provide language services when there is life-threatening implications in here.
It says that that's a factor.
It says that it is more likely than not, and so the plaintiffs, the physicians, understood this to mean that they are required to provide language services to limited English proficient persons and patients. And these physicians do pulmonary and critical care. They do orthopedic surgeries. They provide services to indigent patients, and their allegations, the general allegations in the complaint state, and they are to be considered true when we're looking at a motion to dismiss. These plaintiffs believe that they are required to provide the services to their limited English proficient patients, and that this policy guidance dictates how the physicians are to communicate with their patients. And they are required to provide trained interpreters as well as...
Have they actually applied that four-factor test?
The general allegations make it reasonable to infer that each of the physician plaintiffs did read the policy guidance and determined, based upon their reading, that they are required to provide these services. And it would be in a motion for summary judgment or at trial that these plaintiffs would have to be able to show that they followed through with the four-factor analysis. But on the general allegations that include the sufficient facts to bring this action, they believe, after reading the policy guidance, that they were required to do what the federal government mandated, and that is to provide these language and services to the limited English proficient patients.
What do you do? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Reading the – first of all, there is no allegation that they actually applied the four-factor analysis, right?
It wasn't necessary for us to specify that particular statement in our general allegations in the complaint. It was enough that the plaintiffs –
It seems to me that if you had an injury in fact at this point, you may well have, in my view. It would be from the obligation to apply the four-factor analysis. I mean, the one thing that this guidance seems to require is an analysis. It doesn't necessarily at all require that you provide any particular interpreter services, but it requires that you go through a process. Or it doesn't even quite require that, but at least strongly suggests that you go through a process. The complaint seems to say, well, we were required to provide interpreters, and that doesn't seem supported by the guidance. Now, I don't know if that's a standing problem. Maybe it's a merits problem, but it seems to be a problem.
Well, that would be more to the merits, which we have not been able to get to. What the each of the physicians have stated that it is their reading, their understanding, whether or not they've gone through the four-factor analysis or not, but it is their belief and what they state in the general allegations in the complaint that they are required
but
to provide.
But do you know any case in which an injury, in fact, is turned on somebody's subjective understanding of a legal requirement instead of a legal requirement? In other words, as to whether or not somebody has a legally cognizable injury in fact, can that turn on somebody's subjective understanding of the legal requirement instead of an objective determination of the actual legal requirement?
Well, that's what the declaratory relief cause of action is to determine. They want to know what the legal rights and remedies are under the policy guidance, because right now these physician plaintiffs are being required to, based upon their understanding of the policy guidance, to provide this service. Is that if that is not correct, then under the declaratory relief claim, they should have a decision from a court saying that that is the wrong interpretation. But right now, their belief is that they are required to provide the language services under threat, under a risk that they will be claimed.
Are they providing that service?
Yes, they are. Dr. DeMarco recounts a situation where he was treating a Hispanic patient who had brought her 10-year-old daughter into the examining room with her, who's fluent in English, and he said he could not use the daughter.
Well, that he was surely wrong about, because the policy statement says quite specifically that if he offers to provide an interpreter, and she prefers to have her daughter, that would be fine.
But he was required to provide or let the patient know that the language services.
Let me interject here. We don't know whether he wrongfully interpreted the guidance because he doesn't tell us. I mean, the guidance is actually fairly specific with respect to family members as translators. It says it's permissible, but it gives lots of reasons why in certain cases it may be a bad idea. And it specifically says a recipient may not require an LEP person, limited English proficiency person, to use a family member or friend as an interpreter. Well, Dr. DeMarco doesn't tell us whether what the mother wanted. So we don't know. If he read this to say, well, I can't require, he asked the mother, do you want the daughter to translate? And she said no. Well, of course, then he's required not to use the daughter, but he doesn't say one way or the other.
But he makes it very clear in the allegations that it's his belief that he could not use the daughter, required to provide.
Because of HHS policy guidance, I was not able to use her.
That's right.
I have a little skepticism unless you were to tell me that the mother informed me that she did not want her daughter to act as a translator. The normal situation is, and we know this in the various affidavits filed by your people, actually, that the parents actually, for the most part, they like to have their kids translate.
Well, yes.
So why am I to assume, without him having said so, that the mother here has refused to allow to use the daughter as a translator?
Because Dr. DeMarco believes, as stated in the allegations and the complaint, which we have to take as true, that he could not use the daughter to to translate.
But what he believes and what the regulations require may be different things, which comes back to the question Judge Berzon was asking you. I mean, I fully understand and agree with your argument that the purpose of declaratory judgment serves is you can say, well, listen, I think this requires me to do X, but I really don't want to, and I would argue that it does not or that it cannot, and therefore I want a declaratory judgment. I may even want injunctive relief against the enforcement. But at what point does the interpretation by the plaintiff who brings a declaratory judgment become so removed from anything that might actually be required that we say, right, go away, because your subjective interpretation of this is so demonstrably wrong? At what point, when does that happen?
It happens because in these particular circumstances, each of the plaintiffs are claiming that they fear a risk of intention of an investigation by the Office of Civil Rights, that they are intentionally discriminating. Now, there's case law from Hemp Industries and Covington, which you cite in our briefs, that says that if the plaintiffs have an immediate dilemma of whether or not to change their conduct, which they are doing here, or risk an enforcement action against them, then that type of case is ripe for review, and then ripeness also overlaps standing in those situations.
I have another set of questions on a different point. I'm having a hard time understanding how this 2003 policy guidance is the cause of any injury that these people may have suffered. The complaint refers to incidents from 2001 and 2002. You also to show the enforcement. You also attach a document showing that this is being enforced, but the document is from 7/30/2002, and it shows a whole bunch of enforcement actions before this 2003 document was promulgated. And the government's position, as I understand it, is that we've been enforcing general balancing requirement, flexible requirement, for three decades, and all we are doing in this document is trying to tell people how to assess for themselves, what when they might be required and when they might not be required in order to be helpful, but we really haven't changed anything. So if we were to eliminate this document, how would that help these people?
Because the physician plaintiffs here are claiming that before the policy guidance was adopted, they were able to use their best professional judgment in deciding how best to communicate with their patients. Beforehand, they could do an assessment of whether or not an interpreter or a translator is required.
Now, at the risk of having the same risk of having an enforcement action brought against them if they assessed it wrongly.
Well,
all that's happening is you're being given some assistance in making that determination, so you're less likely to get in trouble.
No, I think as Dr. Caldwell indicates, that prior to the policy guidance, and even today, he does not want to discriminate on any basis whatsoever. Title VI says that you do not discriminate on the basis of national origin, race, or color. But
I'm sorry. You attach to the complaint a list of case summaries. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
It is dated 7/30/2002, right?
Yes.
It recounts a whole bunch of instances in which people there were enforcement actions brought against different entities, saying that they should have had some kind of interpreter service if they didn't have. Right.
That's correct.
So what does this? How does this guidance make him have to go forward in a different way than he would have had to go forward before it?
Because right now, what the policy guidance does is it tells the physician plaintiffs that they are required to provide the language assistance or risk enforcement for national origin discrimination.
But the risk was there before, and it doesn't say you have to. It says here's a bunch of considerations.
But right now what the policy guidance is saying is that language equates to national origin discrimination, and it is the complaint is claiming for declaratory relief that language does not equate to national origin discrimination. In fact, the policy guidance itself recognizes that there is a debate among the commentary on whether or not Alexander versus Sandoval even would allow these types of policy guidances to
take. The following question, assuming that you can get us to agree that they're standing. The next question, of course, is ripeness.
That's right.
Why is this case ripe, or say it this way, what are the questions you seek to litigate, and why is the record and the degree of injury you claim sufficient to allow us to go forward confidently? Why, in other words, shouldn't we wait a little longer to see if an enforcement proceeding is brought with specific enforcement of specific provisions of the guidance with respect to specific activity and so on? Why is this ripe?
Well, first, in hemp industries, which is a Ninth Circuit decision, which is cited in our brief, it says that when physicians have an immediate dilemma to choose between complying with their newly imposed policy guidance or risk serious penalties by enforcement, and here it would be for enforcement for national origin discrimination, that the case is right.
Well, no, I'm asking a slightly different question. I mean, you're answering part of it. What I'm really after is the sort of the Abbott Labs balancing test, because the opinion in that case says, well, you balance off the hardship to the party if you can't adjudicate versus how much more you might learn that would be relevant to the legal disposition if you wait. I'm really after the second point. Will we learn anything more that would be relevant to a legal decision if we wait until, for example, there is an enforcement proceeding?
No, we won't wait. There's no need to wait here because...
Well, you say that because what are the precise legal questions you are now seeking to litigate?
Under the Administrative Procedures Act, we are asking for the court to make a determination on whether or not the policy guidance was adopted in violation of the notice and comment procedures.
And the matter of enforcement is irrelevant to that. Okay. What else do you want to say?
Second is we are asking whether or not the Department of Health and Human Services exceeded its Title VI authorization because they are equating language with national origin,
and
there's nothing to support.
It doesn't sound as though the specifics of the enforcement are terribly relevant to that argument.
No.
Well, it might matter depending if we saw what they enforced it against. I mean, it might be in any individual instance in which they actually enforced it, there was some basis for that equation.
But then you would still have a discrimination lawsuit. But it doesn't necessarily, what the Department of Health and Human Services has done is equated language with national origin. And there is no way that language is the same as national origin, is the way we have argued it in our complaint.
I'm telling people that if you do this balancing test, and follow our guidance, you're a lot less likely to be found to be discriminating on the basis of national origin, because we will see that you, in fact, are accommodating people's language skills. So you're, in other words, I don't know that the two are mutually exclusive. It may be that when we see what they've actually enforced it against, you will see that there is a strong argument of the overlap between a disparate impact and disparate treatment theory in the particular cases in which they're actually enforcing.
But that's necessary for a case-by-case determination. But here, there are no need for factual development. These are legal questions, and we brought a facial complaint against the policy guidance. And when you do have this type of a dilemma for the physicians, that either they have to change their conduct or face the possibility of an enforcement action for national origin discrimination based upon a telephone call from somebody, then the Office of Civil Rights is obligated to follow through and investigate. And
that was true before this 2003 policy guidance.
But before the 2003 policy guidance, before this policy came up, the doctors were able to use their best professional judgment in deciding how best to...
That's the piece I'm having the trouble with. I'm not having trouble with the general notion that if you have something that is in fact mandatory, it doesn't have to be enforced against you before you can have standing. But I'm having trouble understanding what the connection is between this policy guidance and their perception that they have to do some, that there was some kind of risk?
I'd like to answer that question, and then I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. The relationship is with physicians is that their professional reputations are always very, very important because they develop the trust in the community. This policy says that if you are investigated for language, for not providing the language services, you are going to be assumed that you have intentionally discriminated on the basis of national origin. And it is the...
I'm sorry, where does it say that?
Because the way the policy guidance, and this is something that we want to be able to develop, is the policy guidance. And there are no other facts that are necessary, is that the burden is on the physician to show that he is not intentionally discriminating. If they do not provide the specific language assistance. What we need to do is get this back before the district court.
And that was true before the policy guidance.
I'm sorry?
Before the policy guidance, the same burden of proof didn't apply?
No. Before, under intention, if somebody brought an action for intentional discrimination, it's the plaintiff that has to prove that intentional discrimination.
What about this whole list of cases that you attached to your complaint? Those were under a theory that went directly to the LEP, right?
That's right, and that's one of the reasons why we attached that, is to show that there is enforcement taking place.
Right, but not of the policy guidance, because it was before the policy guidance. That's what I don't understand.
This is the third iteration of this particular policy. Mm-hmm. And this is the one that was adopted in August of 2003, and I think we set out some background in our complaint that shows that this is the third iteration of the same type of policy guidance.
Okay.
And so that's
why... You eliminated the 2003 one. We have the earlier ones is in place, no?
The earlier ones are no longer in effect because we now have the 2003 one.
Okay, and you eliminate the 2003 one as your argument?
Then our physician plaintiffs would be able to use their own professional judgment in deciding how best to communicate with their patients.
I have one other question, which is you filed this when in relation to when the 2003 policy guidance?
The 2003 policy guidance was adopted in August of 2003, and in the policy guidance itself it says, it is now in effect, it's going to be enforced, but give us some comments. And you have comments until January of 2004, so we provided comments to the Department of Health and Human Services saying that their legal basis for adopting the policy guidance was in error. And so we waited to see if they would change their policy guidance. Hopefully to rescind it, remove it. And they didn't do it, so he felt that it was necessary to bring a complaint challenging the facial validity of the policy guidance and seek declaratory as well as injunctive relief.
When was that?
Pardon?
When did you file the complaint?
August of 2004.
So is there a limitation within a year of the policy guidance being promulgated? Is that the limitation? What's the limitation period that applies here?
I'm just curious
because you seem to be saying now that this really goes back way before 2003. And the question is, how long can you wait before challenging something like this?
We are challenging the 2003, and I believe it's a two-year or three-year statute of limitations. So the statute of limitations was never a problem in this case.
Yeah, I've got a very specific question. It may or may not prove relevant. I noticed with Dr. Caldwell's affidavit that it's not dated. It says executed this 14th day of December in La Jolla. I'm on page 294 of the excerpts, but it doesn't say the year. Now, it's filed in September 21 of 04, but his affidavit does not contain a year. Can you help us out?
It would have been filed in September of 2004,
filed. I want to know when it was signed.
Pardon?
I know when it was filed because
it
was
dated. And it would have been signed on September 14th, 2004. That was just, an oversight on our part when it was prepared. But I think that declaration clearly shows that prior to the policy guidance being in effect, that he was able to use his own professional judgment.
He just couldn't read. I mean, that's the problem. And he either couldn't read the guidance or he couldn't read the pre-guidance material, because you are telling me that this was the third iteration of a guidance. So it isn't this guidance. It's something earlier, and that something earlier was supposedly just an iteration of what was happening even before that. So, and this goes back to the issue that we were talking about before. I mean, how much deference for standing purposes do we give to his understanding of the law as opposed to the law?
Well, I think under the general allegations and the requirements under a motion to dismiss, when we are looking at the pleadings in a case and no other evidence, that the averments in the complaint are to be taken as true. And Dr. Caldwell, as well as the other plaintiffs, have said, hey, we know what this policy guidance says. It has required us to change our conduct and the manner in which we practice medicine, or we risk enforcement for intentional discrimination. We are going to provide these language services to limited English proficient patients, and it's going to cost us out of our pocket, because it's unreimbursed expenses, just to make sure that we do not, under any circumstances, bring ourselves under the scope of the federal government, because that would injure their reputations and really hurt their livelihoods.
What prompted that reaction when these latest guidelines were promulgated? Why didn't they have the same concerns before?
They did. But on the 2000, because the Department of Health and Human Services kept changing or modifying the policy guidance, this is the first one which seems to be clearly solid. This is a final agency action.
Are you
and that is one of the requirements for rightness.
Does it matter at all that some of the cases that you attach were begun before any of these policy guidances, i.e. they seem to be from 98 and 99?
That list is something that we just took off the Office of Civil Rights website, and it is just to show that they are, in fact, enforcing.
And that they were enforcing it beforehand.
They were enforcing
the Or there was any policy guidance.
The way the Office of Civil Rights works is they try to get voluntary compliance, and they have stated that they have had these types of complaints in the past, and the policy guidance is to more or less create standards. But these are new standards. These were standards that were created that do not have, that is a new interpretation of Title VI. And it is this enforcement sword that's hanging over their heads that's requiring these physicians to actually change their conduct. Now, if that's the wrong interpretation, then that's what the declaratory relief cause of action is supposed to tell them. If they do not have to comply with the policy guidance...
I assume part of your lawsuit, part of your challenge is a straightforward interpretation of the... assuming that there was notice and comment or whatever is necessary for the promulgation of the guidelines, part of your lawsuit is, just tell us what it means.
Tell us what it means, because...
And if the response of the court telling you what it means is, you don't have to do any of these things that in your affidavits you claim you're now having to do in response, you have to go away, right?
Well, that would redress our injuries.
Yeah, right. So you may find out in your declaratory judgment that you're not being able to raise any of your sort of broader claims about the distinction that you want to make between national origin and language discrimination.
But that's part of the policy guidance. That's what the policy guidance is based upon.
That's not my question. But if when the court says, this is what the guidance requires you to do, and the court says, and you've not shown me anything that you do differently in response to the guidelines, your question doesn't arise because there has been no adverse impact upon your clients. Isn't that right?
That's right, but we haven't had that opportunity to go back and...
But I want to see if that's part of your lawsuit. I assume that's part of your lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. We want an interpretation on our rights and responsibilities under the policy guidance.
But only if it turns out your clients are being obliged to do something different from what they ordinarily would do because of these guidelines. Only then do you get to the next set of questions.
That's right.
Okay.
And we would be satisfied with that, being able to present our case before the district court.
Got it.
May it please the Court, this is Ashish Agarwal for the United States. This case can be resolved very cleanly by focusing on the second and third elements required for standing, causation, and redressability. It is not the HHS policy guidelines that create the obligation for plaintiffs to provide translation services. The policy guidelines don't require them to provide translation in any instances. It is Title VI and its implementing regulations, including 45 CFR 80.3 and the executive order issued by President Clinton, that create the obligation on the plaintiffs not to discriminate against people based on their national origin. That has been interpreted and is consistent with the Sandoval decision to require them to provide translation services to people of limited English proficiency. As Judge Berzon's questioning elicited, HHS was applying these guidelines well before 2003. The actual
these guidelines, but was requiring in some instances people to provide services like this, and had and so that these people, these plaintiffs, may have been at the same risk at that point. These exact standards didn't exist. Is that right?
These exact standards did not exist. It's if you look at page 3 of the government's brief, it actually issues the cite for the first time. Similar guidelines were issued in 1970. The cite is 35 Federal Register 11595.
Did the previous guidelines require this four-step, I'll call it, balancing test?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the previous. I believe that they did because
Wait a minute. This is an important question, and an I don't know answer. If you don't know, the answer has to be I don't know, because the question is, what new obligations, if any, does this policy guidance impose? And I'm asking you, did prior to the promulgation of this policy guideline, were these four, was this four-step test incorporated? And
do not know the
answer. Is you don't know.
I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. I can tell you that the HHS guidelines were based on guidelines that were first issued by the Department of Justice in, I believe it was 2001.
Yeah, but having said that, you still don't know the answer to the question.
There were several iterations between 2001 and 2003, and I don't know as to, among those iterations, what when was the first time the HHS guidelines actually went through and set forth the four-factor analysis. Prior to 2001, they would not have set forth the four-factor balancing test that was created by DOJ.
I'm looking at these 2003 guidelines, and it says, the purpose of this policy guidance is to assist recipients in fulfilling their responsibilities. This policy guidance clarifies existing legal requirements by providing a description of the factors recipients should consider in fulfilling their responsibilities to LEP persons. That sounds as though the four-step test is new. I'd have to say I've not gone back to look at the other, but it sounds as new. These are the same criteria HHS will use in evaluating whether recipients are in compliance with Title VI and the Title VI regulations. Looking now solely at the 2003 regulations, is it a requirement imposed by this policy guidance that a medical services provider go through this four-step analysis?
No, Your Honor. If you look at the,
I'll just read it to you.
Sure.
It says recipients are required. The word is required to take reasonable steps to ensure meaningful access to their programs and activities. While designed to be a flexible and fact-dependent standard, the starting point is an individualized assessment that balances the following four factors. Then the factors are listed. So the required in the first sentence of that paragraph does not include that a requirement that this four-step assessment be done?
That's correct, Your Honor. You can certainly...
How do you get there with this language?
Sure, because in the second sentence of the paragraph you're reading, it says it's the starting point for the analysis. Now, you can certainly...
But it sounds as though that's the analysis that must be undertaken.
Sure, but you can certainly imagine factual situations in which there's no need for a physician to go through a four-step analysis.
But what page are you looking at?
This is page 8, Your Honor. It's in the blue brief, page 8 of the
It's actually on page 8 of the regulations as well, but it's on page 8 of your brief.
I'm sorry, no, it's page 8 of the regulation, Your Honor.
But my understanding is that you stood up here and decided that it was the better part of valor, and I think you're probably right, to not argue that there was no injury in fact here, even though your brief argues that at some length. And the injury in fact could be either the require. I mean, would you agree that it would be an injury in fact, meaning something you have to do that you didn't have to do before, if you simply had to go through this analysis, without regard to whether you actually had to, the physician actually had to provide, at the end of the analysis, translators or didn't have to provide translators?
Your Honor, I am not aware of a case in which having to spend a few moments contemplating the impact of a regulation is enough to confer standing. I think for a court to adopt that expansive of a view of standing would essentially negate standing, because in every conceivable instance, a physician or any private person sometimes will have to read a regulation.
At some point, a procedural requirement has to become standing. I mean, NEPA, for example, NEPA has a special standing rule, essentially, because having to go through the process of doing it is itself an obligation. And this seems to be saying, and even says you may want to write it down, you may want to document it, and so on. So
none of those are requirements, Your Honor, so we understand.
Well, they're certainly the better part of valor, let's put it that way, of any kind of for a sizable institution who may be faced with this obligation if they want to be able to document later why they did whatever they did. So why isn't that sufficient? Injury, you know, is a funny word in this context, but it's a legal obligation, and why isn't that good enough?
Well, Your Honor, like I say, I don't think that we have a assessment here of an actual injury to the plaintiffs that they articulate
well,
in their declaration.
They didn't allege they did this, or and so that's a different problem. But or that they were going to do it, they just alleged they jumped in and said that we simply have to do this without going through the and didn't say it was the result of the analysis. But my question is, would the obligation to go through the analysis be sufficient basis for them to complain that they shouldn't have to go through the analysis?
I do not think it's a sufficient basis, Your Honor, and the reason is that we have no concept of how costly or burdensome this is on the plaintiff. This
is why isn't just any injury in fact can be a pittance, right? Can be a pittance. There's no de minimis rule.
If a court were to adopt such a rule, I think it would essentially negate the requirement of standing, because I think every time you have any policy guideline or regulation promulgated by any agency, I think it is incumbent upon people who are regulated to at least look and make a consideration and determination as to whether that guideline applies to them and requires them to adjust their conduct. If that is to be standing becomes meaningless.
Now, I think it's a fair inference from these affidavits we have from the various plaintiffs that they have performed the four-step test, although they don't say that. What they do is say the guidance requires me to do X. Now, how can they know that the guidance requires me to do X, or even think that the guidance requires me to do X, unless they've gone through the four-step analysis? And now we find, for example, I'm now just reading from the affidavit of, I don't know why you guys keep calling them declarations. In federal practice, they should be affidavits, but I guess Californians like the word declaration. Okay, so I'm reading the declaration of Dr. Bronfman. In paragraph 4, the second sentence, he says, the HHS policy guidance has a direct adverse impact on the manner in which I practice medicine. I'm required to provide interpreters in any requested language at my cost and to assure that such interpretations are competent, da-da-da. Well, it's kind of general, but sounds as though he has changed his practice in response to the policy guidelines. That's what he's telling us. What's your response to that in the sense of, okay, if the policy guidance goes away, he's telling us, I don't have to do this and I won't?
2 points, Your Honor. First,
so why does he have a standing problem?
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, misreading policy guidelines should not create standing.
And how do you know he has misread them?
Well, I'm not speaking about Dr. Brothman, but I know that I believe it was Dr. DeMarco whose declaration set forth that he was prohibited from using the bilingual daughter of a patient. That's clearly wrong.
Well, not necessarily. He didn't say one way or the other as to whether or not the mother objected. If the mother objected, he is prohibited. If the mother did not object, he's not.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we don't know whether he's misinterpreted because we don't know that piece of information.
That's correct, Your Honor, but it is the plaintiff's burden. It is always the plaintiff's burden to establish standing, and I would contend that they have failed to do so here. Now, as to your general point, I think what the question really highlights is the need for this court to wait to hear this case until we have an enforcement action from HHS. Because until we have an enforcement action from HHS, or until HHS seeks to cut off the plaintiff's federal funding, we're talking in abstractions. And as cases,
is that a righteous argument or a standing argument?
It gets to both factors, Your Honor, because there's the requirement in ripeness of final agency action. There's obviously the requirement in standing of injury in
fact.
Are
you saying that the promulgation of the policy guidelines is not final agency action within the meaning of the APA?
That is correct, because there has been no enforcement action against the plaintiffs. I'm sorry.
Are you saying that the promulgation of the policy guidance is not a final agency action within the meaning of the APA?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just to say that no matter what these would say, these policy guidelines are simply not final agency action within that can't be.
If the guidelines required the plaintiffs to take any concrete, particularized action, I think it would, but it doesn't here. This is very different from the Hemp case, for example, in which it was impossible for those plaintiffs to.
I think you're confusing the term final agency action within the meaning of the APA and coercion upon people through enforcement actions. Those are two quite different concepts.
Well, final agency action, one of the elements that goes into final agency action, Your Honor, is whether there's a need for factual development, whether there's a need for facts. And here, it would be our view that you do need to make an evaluation about how these guidelines would be implemented and interpreted by HHS. Because
suppose
until
this was promulgated as a regulation, and it said you have to provide interpreter services in the following four circumstances, but there was no enforcement action brought against anybody. Would they then have standing?
No, I don't think they would, Your Honor, because I think
aren't there many cases in that posture where somebody is in the category of person covered and this places an obligation on them, and they come and say, I have reason to think I have to choose between complying with this regulation and doing what I think I have to do, and that's sufficient.
There are many cases like that, Your Honor. The Abbott Labs case and the Hemp case both speak to that. But the in those cases, there are several differences among them. That in those cases, you have the possibility of criminal penalties imposed on the parties. So the need for a speedier resolution was much more clear.
Losing your livelihood is a pretty good reason not to.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Possibly losing your livelihood if you're dependent on Medicaid or Medicare patients is certainly a good reason to think to be worried.
Well, Your Honor, that possibility is at best remote here. And all of the what we've been labeling enforcement actions by HHS, those have all been resolved voluntarily. In other words, HHS was able to negotiate with the plaintiff, with the physicians.
Negotiate another word for bully? I mean, sometimes negotiation is, listen, I'm going to do something that's going to be very expensive to you, and unless you want to undergo the expense, I suggest that you do the following. Now, I have no idea what these negotiations did or how they were carried out and so on, but negotiation doesn't mean that it was a peaceable process, and it doesn't mean that there was a sort of a iron fist in the velvet glove.
Fair enough, Your Honor, and the record, of course, doesn't speak to what happened in each of those cases, but it is true that HHS has never sought to cut off federal funding for a physician or a covered entity pursuant to these guidelines.
But they threatened to.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, and I don't think it's clear from the record.
What are they saying in the negotiations then? They're saying, we won't do anything to you if you totally ignore us, but would you please, pretty please, do what these guidelines want you to do?
Your Honor, HHS does provide technical assistance covered entities. Clearly, though, you're right. At the end of the day, what is out there is the prospect of an enforcement action. It has never, in the history of well, the short history of the 2003 guidelines, but even prior to that, has HHS ever, you know, gone to the point of having to issue a report to the House and the Senate?
Let me ask you something. If there was an enforcement action under Title VI disparate impact regulation as applied to an LEP situation, would you be relying on this policy guidance for Chevron or Skidmore deference purposes? The answer is almost surely yes.
I think the answer is yes, Your Honor. I haven't talked to my client about that specifically, but I think the answer is yes. Although I really do need to come.
He's a fool if he doesn't.
Sure, I do need to come back to a point though, which is that, you know, the guidelines, other than, do not really require anything. All the guidelines, even in terms of the four factor analysis, the guidelines just say that it is a starting point for something that physicians should do.
For example, there was an enforcement action brought against somebody and you could establish that they had never gone through this process. That wouldn't be a factor in your favor if it was a court challenge?
That could be a factor in our favor, but it's not required. There's no requirement that any physician, you know, go through and document each of these four factors or do any sort of type of extensive analysis.
You know, I'm not sure that you're right, although it's a little unclear from the guidelines. I'm just reading later on. It's after the several pages after. It's on page 17. But this is a discussion of what might or might not be required with respect to family members used as translators. The guidelines are pretty skeptical about using family members as translator in certain circumstances, and I actually kind of share the skepticism. There'll be certain matters of privacy, embarrassment, all kinds of reasons why you might not want your 10-year-old child to be a translator to describe all your medical ills. And it says specifically, a recipient, that is to say, the health provider, may not require an LEP person to use a family member or friend as an interpreter. That's not just, hey, here's a four-step test, and then you kind of do what you want afterwards. That's a very specific direction. And I assume that if you can prove that someone comes in with the mom comes in with a 10-year-old daughter. She has an ailment that is in some respect quite embarrassing, or for maybe not embarrassing reasons, but for other reasons important to her, she does not want her 10-year-old daughter to know about it. And she says, please don't make me use my daughter. If I have to, I will, because I need to be treated, but please don't make me do it. And the doctor says, sorry, she's by far the best translator we got. If you want treatment, you've got to use the daughter. I assume that's in violation of the guidelines, and I assume that would be the basis for an enforcement proceeding. Is that wrong?
Clearly it would be in violation of the guidelines, because obviously it's set forth here. Unclear as to whether it would form the basis for an enforcement action, though, Your Honor, and you can imagine a number of situations in which HHS could decide in its discretion not to seek to cut off funding.
I'm not talking prosecutorial.
Life-threatening injury, and there's no time, among other things.
But if the HHS decided in the wise exercise of its discretion that it wished to use this as a basis for an enforcement action, I assume it could, because it's a clear violation.
And Your Honor, what I would say to this court is that it would be better to wait for that factual situation to arise rather than issue an advisory opinion on something that might never happen.
And in the meantime, what's a doctor supposed to do? Is a doctor supposed to say, well, I have to abide by this? Or the doctor to say, well, I guess I'm told because I don't have any standing, that means I don't have any injury, which means I don't have to change my behavior, which means I guess I don't have to abide by this. Now, most doctors, conscientiously trying to follow the law, will conscientiously follow the law. I assume that a doctor reading this will say, in the circumstance that I've just hypothesized, which I freely state is much more elaborated than we got out of this very short affidavit, I assume the doctor will comply. And he might not have complied without this guidance. Or rather, he might not have done it without the guidance because he's complying with the guidance.
And if that happened one way or the other, whichever way the doctor chose to act, we would then have a concrete and particularized case that would meet the requirements of Article 3.
Why don't we have it right now, given these affidavits, to say, you know, I am changing my behavior in response. And one of the arguments then in the case would be, okay, let's find out exactly what behavior you are changing, and let's decide whether or not it's in violation of the guidelines. Isn't the doctor entitled to that from a court of law?
There's, in theory, yes, but there's certainly not enough here in the complaint or in the declarations to satisfy the elements of our of Article III, to create a case or controversy. For example, the arguments that are set forth in the declarations and the complaint allege that they've had to there are discussions about the cost of translators, but there's no allegation that they've ever actually had to pay for a translator.
Hey, now, come on. I you mean they're getting all this translation for free?
Yeah, in some cases, they're, it's not costing them anything, Your Honor. Dr. Caldwell, for example, states clearly that his hospital or clinic has translators on staff. That money's not coming out.
He takes more time to provide the medical care, and it interferes with his the First Amendment issues don't seem to me to be very illuminating, but he says that it's more difficult for him to communicate that way, which isn't crazy. I mean, I've been to doctors in foreign countries and have managed to deal with them, and I'm not sure a translator would have been better.
That is in the declaration, Your Honor, but there's no allegation that 30 to 50% more time that he has to spend on LEP patients is due to the guidelines. That requirement comes from Title VI, the implementing regulations, and quite frankly, just good practice.
To me, is what does the guidelines have to do with all?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I was cutting.
To me, again, to where you started from, to be the most difficult issue here, which is what do the guidelines have to do with this problem? But insofar as you're backing into arguments that there's no injury, that seems to me to be a much more difficult argument. I have a question that's probably irrelevant to anything, and I will ask your opponent as well. One of the two main causes of action here is that there was no notice and comment. Wasn't there notice and comment? I mean, there was the 2002 there were comments on the 2002 guidance, and then they promulgated the 2003 guidance, and then they said, you know, and then after that they said, well, we'll take some more comments. But all along they've been giving notice and taking comments before, and obviously you take comments in order to change things, in order to respond to the comments. So the fact that the 2003 guidelines was different than the 2002 guidelines is, of course, what you're going to do after comments. So I don't understand that argument.
It is correct that HHS did receive comments. They did adjust the guidelines based on those comments. It's set forth on page 2 of the guidelines, though, where it says that that they determined that the guidance does not constitute a regulation subject to the rulemaking requirements of the APA. I don't know precisely what it is that HHS did or did not do that would have been otherwise required by the APA.
I see. Okay.
Well, just to sum up, I would encourage this, if there are no other questions, I would just encourage this court to...
what was the reason for not going through the notice and comment process in 2002?
Well, there was a determination...
You're doing it by executive order.
Sure. Well, there was a determination that notice and comment rulemaking wasn't necessary for a variety of reasons, including that they weren't changing, that they weren't substantively changing what the guidelines had been previously. Thanks very much.
So,
in other words, they may have been saying...
Yeah. 2003...
Your Honor, I'm sorry, that gets back to Judge Fletcher's initial question to me, which is how did the 2003 guidelines differ, and I'm afraid I'm not in a position to, I don't know exactly
how they differ. Isn't that essential to your argument that there's no addressability or there's no causation? I mean, we need to know what the relationship between the various sequential pieces here to know why this last one mattered if it mattered.
No, I don't think it is, Your Honor, because the legal requirements come from Title VI and the implementing regulations, not from the guidelines and not from any predecessor to the guidelines.
Have you covered all that?
That's all in the brief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if we ask you to send us a supplemental brief, the question we just asked you about the difference between the, between the 2003 and the 2002, which you haven't looked at, that would be a problem for you, would it?
Not at all. I'd be happy to do so if you're asking me to do that now.
Well, I think you'd volunteer to do that.
we'll do, Your Honor. Thanks very much.
When are you going to get it to us?
I'm sorry?
When will we have it? Monday morning?
Well, actually, the government is closed in Washington right now due to a snowstorm. So is 3 weeks soon enough, Your Honor?
How big a snowstorm we got?
I don't know.
Well,
we can do it in two.
The universe was created in 6 days.
If the court would like it by the end of next week, we can do that.
All right.
Thanks, Your Honor.
I'd like to just, do I get a chance to reply to his supplemental letter to you on the second and third versions?
How long will it take you?
A lot less time.
I'm sure you get a chance.
Okay, 5 days after he submits his?
Sure.
Okay. But actually, I'm rather puzzled because the policy guidance itself, when it talks about that it is not within the rulemaking process of the APA, is one of our causes of action. It is the first claim. We are saying that this is it's a substantive rule. It's a legislative rule. It's reinterpreting the Health and Human Services regulation as well as Title VI. And because it's a new interpretation, it needs to go through the APA rulemaking process, which means notice and comment. Now, a notice and comment does not mean that as soon as it's released by Health and Human Services, it goes into effect immediately. What they do is they put it in the Federal Register and they invite comments. Health and Human Services did not invite comments. It said, here's the policy guidance. It's in effect. If you want to make comments, then go ahead and do it. But it was in effect even before the comments were available, and that is our first claim.
But you may be right that this is a merits question, unless the 2002 guideline promulgation and the notice and comment for that was essentially the required notice and comment, and because this is simply a response to those notice and comments. And that's why I was kind of mystified, but I don't. What I'm having the biggest trouble with is the fact that at times you're saying the 2003 policy guidance is really what your case is about, and at other points you're saying, well, no, it isn't really what your case is about because this goes back to at least to 2000 and maybe before that. And that's where I have trouble seeing how you're going to be redressed by getting rid of the 2003 guidelines.
We haven't made ourselves clear. The only reason that there is that confusion is we did attach to our complaint the case summaries, Exhibit 6.
And you made allegations in your complaint concerning things that happened before 2000.
That the Health and Human Services, in fact, enforcing it. And so that causes the risk to the plaintiffs that they would be susceptible to being hauled before the federal government. Even if it's going to be a voluntary compliance, they are at risk for their professional livelihoods.
I'm not sure this makes a difference, but it might. This is an odd way to cast the lawsuit, not with respect to the policy guidelines and with respect to notice and comment as of the 2003 guidance. I understand that you're challenging this particular policy guidance. But the claim in which your clients actually seem much more interested in is whether or not any form of sort of translation services may be required in the treatment of patients. And that claim really runs not only against the 2003, it runs against the regulations that you're purporting not to challenge.
No, we're not challenging the regulations because the regulations don't require language services. It says that you are not able to discriminate on the basis of race, color, or national origin. And so even with the policy guidance, the 2003 or the 2002, there is no underlying authority of the Health and Human Services to require the language services.
Are you challenging? I thought you were challenging the disparate impact, right?
No, we're not. We're just challenging the policy guidance. The regulation itself on its face.
You are challenging the requirement in any application of Title VI to require to language discrimination, essentially.
That's right. The Health and Human Services is relying upon, we believe, a misreading of Title VI, saying that language equates to national origin. We say that there are two different things. And
does it make any difference? Let's suppose we decide that core interpretation goes back to 1970, which I don't know if it does, but that's what they're contending. Now, does that have any impact on your lawsuit? Can you come wandering in 2007 and say, I dispute this thing that they've been telling us since 1970? And maybe you can. I mean, I just don't know the answer to that question.
Well, actually, we were able to dispute it. We had two additional declarations in our motion for a preliminary injunction.
But I'm asking procedurally. Procedurally, if your underlying problem really goes back to 1970, what you're really unhappy about is any notion that you have to provide, any interpretation services, because you say language discrimination is not national origin discrimination, period, and any obligation you impose upon us to even think about that for 30 seconds is no good. And that obligation to think about it for 30 seconds certainly preexisted even the 2000 guidelines, at least to think about it for 30 seconds. And can you come now in and complain about that?
Well,
I don't know if it's a statute of limitations problem. I don't know if it's an APA problem.
Because we believe that this is a current interpretation by Health and Human Services. And we had a declaration by
Mr. Scott. So if there had been a regulation on the books in 1970 that said this totally explicitly, and the answer to this may be yes, but can Dr. Caldwell show up now in 2007 and say, you know what, I just figured out that under this regulation in 1970, I'm going to have to provide some interpreters, and I think that's a wrong regulation, so I'm going to affirmatively bring a lawsuit now. Could he do that?
I believe he could, because it's a continuing injury to him. And so he would be able to challenge it as it applies to
but
him.
But the APA doesn't have any time limits on bringing challenges to agency interpretations or agency regulations. It does, right?
I'm assuming it does, but that's not this case, and so we don't really have to go there. What we are challenging is the 2003 policy guidance, which is requiring these physicians to change the manner they practice medicine and to also eliminate their own professional judgment. We believe that there is...
it just seems to me that you can dream up exceptions, but language has certainly got a lot to do with national origin. How you may get someone from some country and the person led a very isolated life and doesn't speak the language of the country of their birth and speaks another language, but can't happen very often. Of course, the Russian aristocracy, they didn't speak Russian, they spoke French. Maybe we can apply it to them, but they're not around anymore.
But I think as we've been able to...
There's no parity between language and national origin.
Again, our general allegations in our complaint state that we believe that Title VI...
doctors, when they're in medical school and when they're doing their internships and all that, they learn how to deal with patients who speak languages other than English.
That's right, and they were not charging if they don't provide the language interpretations. They were not under a risk of enforcement for national origin discrimination. They, as Dr. Caldwell says, there's numerous methods that he has employed prior to this mandate by the federal government on telling him how he's going to communicate with his patients. He doesn't want to discriminate. He mentions that he does not want to discriminate, and he hasn't done it in the past. And these new
How did he do it now? How did he do it before these regulations were promulgated?
Well, that's what the general allegations in our complaint says, well, that he was able to do it.
Just tell me how he does it, how he did it before. How did he do it before?
It would be a case-by-case determination based upon the patient's needs, whether or not he can communicate with them, in English or through body language or whatever. But he makes sure that he is able to communicate with each of his patients to make sure that they understand. He understands the injury, that they understand the diagnosis, that they understand the treatment.
How do the new regulations preclude that?
It doesn't preclude, but what it does is saying what it's doing, it's creating a new standard of care for these physicians. It's the federal government is now telling the physicians how to practice medicine, that it is eliminating their professional judgment on how best to treat theirs.
How is that happening?
Because they are mandating, they are saying that
they're not mandating anything.
They are requiring that four-part test, balancing test, and our physicians.
Is there a word "may" there?
No, they are required. They are required to do the four-part test.
So are you now saying that it's the four-part test that's the injury?
Just thinking about the four-part test.
What we are saying is that the policy guidance, that they are the object
policy. What's the injury?
That they are being forced.
Think 1, 2, 3, 4, that's the injury?
No, because under the policy guidance, they are being required to change the manner they're practicing medicine.
That is a much more difficult argument because nothing in that guidance says that. I've looked back very carefully on the part about the importance. It still doesn't say you have to provide a translator. It says that this is a factor. And it talks about how you balance that factor.
You think a doctor who's been practicing and dealing with folks from another country who has worked out his own methods of communication with that person, probably knows a few words of their language or maybe a few phrases, that's somehow if he employs that process, is going to get in big trouble?
Their fear.
Where does it say that?
The regulations say
you have to think about certain things, and then you know it's may after that. Think about it, then you may not. How long does it take to think about it?
And if they think wrong, there is the risk of being hauled before the federal government under a threat of national origin discrimination. It is this threat that is hanging over their heads that they need to get resolved.
I think maybe we need to stop because we've been going in the same circles, but where I have trouble then is in knowing why that threat can exist. Exactly the same threat.
Because under the policy guidance makes it clear that any informal complaint against a physician to the federal government is going to be investigated. And so they have no assurances.
In any case.
But it makes it clear here. There's the risk of enforcement by the federal government. There's risk of increased medical insurance premiums. There's the cost involved. There is just the fear of personal liability. These physicians, as was stated in the Conant versus Walters case, that the physicians are particularly vulnerable to threats of enforcement by the federal government, and they are going to do everything that they can to avoid coming into court. And what this lawsuit is about is...
What is that based on? I've been seeing the same doctor for 50 years. He's never told me he fears any threats on the part of the federal government.
The policy guidance itself says...
What's going on here? They just don't like to be regulated?
Well, certainly they don't want the regulation to interfere with the way they practice medicine.
Okay, well, so how will this regulation interfere with the way they practice?
Because right now it's according to the general allegations in the complaint that each of these physicians has changed the manner they're practicing medicine by bringing a translator or...
Tell me how, just objectively and reasonably, how this regulation, you know, would cause them to change. I mean, maybe they've got a lot of fears. Maybe they've been reading this medical economics book that's probably put out by insurance company that scares them so they can get higher premiums. But show me.
The general allegations in the complaint, as well as the affidavits, disclose that each of the plaintiffs, the physician plaintiffs, are under belief that the policy guidance requires them to provide these services, the language services, to each and every one of their limited English proficient patients.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that.
The allegations are to be considered true in the complaint.
Well, if they're obviously incorrect.
But that is something that would be established in a motion for summary judgment. It's certainly not to be established on the general allegations of the complaint.
Something that may help here. It's not written in stone that you make a standing determination once and for all based only on the allegations in the complaint. You can make the standing determination after further investigation as to both, okay, what is it that this policy guidance actually requires, and what is it based upon sometimes more than just an affidavit or two. Okay, and what is it that you've done in response that's different from what you otherwise would have done? So even if you survive at this stage, you may or may not survive later, but there's nothing that requires the court once and for all to determine standing at the very beginning, and there's, oh, I made a mistake, but I'm stuck with you deciding you now have standing.
That's right. We have to make sure that we establish standing at every single phase.
This is something that's somewhat confusing me. There were declarations... Here,
because they were attached to a motion for preliminary injunction, which the court denied after he found that under a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b.
So your understanding is that the only thing he decided was the pleadings. He didn't decide anything based on the declaration.
You look at the order, and a fair reading of the order says no. He did not look at anything but the general allegations in the complaint.
So that's what we should be looking at as well.
We should be looking at. Okay. Thank you.
What did the order say?
The order says that the plaintiffs were dismissed for lack of standing and lack of rightness.
And what?
Lack of rightness. The matter wasn't right.
But on 12b-1, right?
On 12b-1, and there was also 12b-6.
But on 12b-1, you could have declarations.
We could have, but we didn't have them. And the order itself makes it pretty clear that the court did not rely upon anything but the general allegations.
Well, how does that order make it clear?
I think it said so. There's no indication. I guess it's a matter of what's not there, and there's nothing in the order that shows that he referred to the affidavits. But it was interesting because...
Well, you know, I mean, here, you know, I just have to say this, that in my view, Judge Moskowitz is a very careful, thorough, excellent U.S. District Judge. He gives it, he goes into all these details here.
I agree, he's a very fine judge.
Yeah.
But he seemed to not follow the requirements of the rule. And the same type of case that you've cited in Harris versus Los Angeles County's Board of Supervisors, where the general allegations in the complaint embrace the specific findings, and when there's a credible threat of enforcement, that this is the type of case that deserves to go back into court for a resolution under the declaratory judgment.
So the test is credible threat of enforcement, whether it's credible or not, huh?
Or... And the hemp industry case also mentions that when there is a risk of serious enforcement, that the case would be appropriate. So, and under Abbott Labs.
Okay.
Thank you.
This matter is all submitted, and we'll recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All right.
If we bargain down to a week from Friday.